Hey everybody, this is Ben from the Perfect Bomb Podcast, and before we get to this week's episode, I just want to say that you might notice that we make no mention of the biggest news out of the comic book world from last week, and that is, of course, the passing of Stan Lee at the age of 95. Now, the reason for this is because we record these episodes in bunches, and it just so happens that Stan Lee died right after we recorded a whole bunch of new episodes. So that's why you won't hear us talk about him for a couple weeks. But we got a whole bunch of great episodes in the pipeline until then, and I promise we'll acknowledge Stan Lee's contribution to the industry once we all find ourselves back at the Comics Dungeon in beautiful downtown Wallingford in early December. So thank you for listening, and now on with this week's episode.
Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
We're all joking.
Cole Horn today.
Hey, Ben.
And Nicole Lamb.
Don't die from embarrassment.
How is everybody?
Well,
besides not joking.
I think, you know, we reached a point of passage here at the table.
Did we? We learned things.
Yeah.
Like, into the next life.
Yeah.
People who die from choking in restaurants, it's because they excuse themselves
they
and not
get
stay
up,
there.
Yep. Go into the bathroom or they go outside because they don't want people to know.
The universal sign for choking is...
Mm-hmm. Which
for
I was
those
not
watching
taught
on
that
YouTube.
I'm choking. And then, we were taught the Heimlich. You know.
So in theater, if you're having a bad time, can you get that message out?
Like, I'm choking. Like, put your hands like you're choking yourself.
Actually, get me out of here.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm dying.
It's the noose.
Here.
It's the noose look.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the noose.
For those
who
don't want to look on YouTube, right. Try to describe it. Yeah.
Yes, if you want to see all these fascinating hand signals, check out
truly.
Our YouTube channel.
This is a bird. See?
Check out our YouTube channel. Just go to search for the Panel Jumper. You will find the video podcast that is put together by our video podcast producer, Webster Polk. Thank
Yay,
you, Webster.
Hey, Webster. Webster.
All right.
This is a bird. My name is George.
All right,
don't make fun of my birds, Nicole.
No, it was great. I just had to feel it myself.
What do you got for us, Ben?
Vulture.com had an article recently about the third season of Daredevil. On Netflix. Netflix is Marvel's Daredevil.
Yes.
And Bullseye is the primary antagonist in season 3. I have not watched season 3
yet. I'm halfway through.
And so the writer of this article called up Marv Wolfman. And he's like, hey, Bullseye. Because Wolfman created Bullseye back in co-created Bullseye. And so this writer was like, hey, Daredevil's in season 3. How do you feel about that? And Marv's like, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. But Marv Wolfman was being really cool about it. He's like, that's great. That's fantastic. You know,
yeah.
I'm glad the character has a life.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Reading this article, I totally expected Wolfman to be like, how dare they not tell me? That's my property, blah, blah, blah.
Meh.
But he's like,
he
I can't
probably
wait to
knows
it.
How this all goes
yeah,
down.
Yeah, he knows he's screwed no matter
yeah,
what.
Exactly.
So the point of the article is not that Netflix had a social faux pas and didn't tell Marv about Bullseye being in the TV show, but the characterization of Bullseye has changed dramatically since Bullseye was introduced. He was this kind of goofy, grandstanding
he was a
character.
Throwaway bad guy. He was like a bad guy of the week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now
or the month rather.
Now he's not that.
No.
The tone is a bit darker these days. And I believe in the TV show he's a mentally ill.
He's in the TV show. He's an FBI agent.
An FBI agent. That's
who
what I'm trying
is
to go.
Who has borderline personality disorder.
That's right.
And is can make any. Basically, the gist of Bullseye that as was developed prior to Frank Miller getting his hands on him and through the Elektra story is that Bullseye can turn anything. Can I have that pencil there? You can turn anything into a weapon. You know.
Don't do it.
You know. And there's a moment in the TV show where he's actually throwing. And they don't call him Bullseye in the TV series. They just call him
not yet
Poindexter. Right.
Dex.
Yeah, Dex. But he's he's like, you know, impaling people with pencils, and there's
this is making me nervous.
I don't have that skill. You know, it'll just go plunk in the center of the table. But I've got to tell you, one of the most violent moments in my in a comic book in my childhood is when Bullseye slices Elektra's throat with a playing card, and he shoots it like this, and it just cuts right. And that was some of the most effective cinematic storytelling in a comic book, and such unrestrained violence that I don't think I'd ever seen anything like that before. But they are capturing that quality pretty successfully in Daredevil season 3.
Cool. Yeah, I didn't know Bullseye outside of the, what was it, the 2003 Daredevil movie with Ben Affleck?
Oh, that's right.
Colin Farrell.
Yeah, yeah. And he's got the brand in his
yeah,
forehead.
He's got the Bullseye brand. But it's, so terrible. He was such a silly character in that movie.
He went back to being silly.
So anyway, that got me thinking about these sort of tone shifts in characters through the ages, how Bullseye went from comedy to drama, kind of, to put him in the lamest terms. What do we have any other examples of characters that have made such a grand tone shift?
Well, the most recent one is between the comic book and the MCU with Black Panther, and I've mentioned it before, that Shuri is a very different character in the comic book. She's very lighthearted in the movies, and she's very serious in the comics. And it looks like now they're going forward with her the way she is in the movie with some of the comic books, because we now have a Shuri comic, and she seems to be more emulating that style.
So the Shuri comic is based on off the movie Shuri.
I haven't read it. Have you read it?
Not yet.
It looked like it was emulating
it's
that.
Much more lighthearted.
Yeah, so it's tonally shifting there now.
Yeah, the one that stands out most in my mind is Dr. Light. And Dr. Light was always kind of a buffoon bad guy, fighting the original Teen Titans. He's been in Teen Titans Go. But in 2004, mystery suspense writer Brad Meltzer was hired by DC because sales were flagging, so they were trying to get more novelists to contribute their storylines. And so he wrote this, was it a 9-part series, Identity Crisis?
Something like that.
Yeah. And this series, I point to that series as the darkening of DC superhero comics. Yeah, we had The Watchmen, we had Dark Knight, we had those stories, but those were kind of self-contained. This series really started to, it sold really well. It because they had a best-selling suspense and crime novelist writing it, but it started saying it was okay to put more real-world violence and pathology into superhero comics. So in this story, they reveal that this buffoon-like character actually at one point had raped Sue Dibney on the JLA space station, and Sue Dibney is the wife of Ralph Dibney, the Elongated Man, and they've always been very comical, whimsical characters, and all of a sudden it got hardcore, dark, and cruel. And that made for well-selling comic books. What eventually happened was that in the course of that story, it's revealed that, well, he did all those terrible, terrible things in the past, and the JLA with Zatanna did essentially a mind wipe on him, but in so doing, lobotomized him, making him the buffoon character that we knew all this time. Am I remembering this correctly?
Yep, yeah, it was a magical lobotomy.
Yeah, but I really felt like I then started seeing a lot of characters that were lovable and chummy and whimsical go dark and go hardcore. And the next thing was what they did. And was it Meltzer writing Justice League? Who was writing Justice League at that time?
He did do a chunk after that run.
So we had the character Max Lord, who became this very cruel dictator character, just a bloodthirsty leader of... Go ahead.
It was a little bit more Greg Rucka's fault on that one,
okay.
I think.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
And Rucka was a crime writer, too. But.
And because there was OMAC Project and all that stuff that led to the darker
But you know, Max Lord was the secret head of the Justice League in the 80s, which is the most whimsical depiction of that superhero team I think you're ever going to find, and I loved it. And Max Lord was basically patterned on visually McGuire, who's the artist.
Kevin Maguire,
and he based him on Sam Neill as Damian Thorne in Omen 3. That's what he looked like in those early comics. But he was still a comical character. And then they revealed that he did have a superpower, but he was actually like this corporate businessman who was putting money into the Justice League so he could have his own corporate superhero team. So there was a tongue-in-cheek, but then it got super-duper dark. He's running Checkmate, and he kills
Blue Beetle.
Yeah. And does he kill Booster? And that's in the 52 series.
It was part of the Infinite Crisis lead up and all that.
It just to my mind got unnecessarily cruel and dark.
So as part of the Identity Crisis wave, they found that they could use the magical mind wipe as an excuse to change a bunch of villains. Mm-hmm. And John's used that quite a bit. And Flash has the Rogues Gallery, which has a bunch of very ridiculous villains. And one of them was a guy named The Top, who was a man who span around in a circle very fast. And he wore green and yellow, and he just looked like a spinning top.
And if he fell down, you were awake.
Yep. and so he, so they did a thing where they're like, oh, he was also mind wiped. And it turned out that he had actually a pretty creepy power that when he was doing that, he could mess up your own perception of the world, and that he was a master manipulator and basically kind of a creepy serial killer. So there was a couple wave of those kind of villains having that, that phase as well during that time.
But they could tell cruel stories about these characters and then retroactively remove that cruelty? Is that what you're saying?
That they can say that they would explain why the character was a loser in the modern era and then uncork that and turn them into real threats.
Got it.
Because they felt that they needed to ump everybody's ante,
I point the finger at Identity Crisis.
Right? A lot of people did it beforehand because Jeff Loeb in Long Halloween and Dark Victory made Calendar Man basically into Hannibal Lecter.
Good point.
Identity Crisis was definitely amped everything up.
Yeah.
But I feel like the early 2000s was when all of editorial was like, we got to make these darker. We got to make everything grimmer.
Really good point.
We got to make old. But then they looked at their cast of villains and they're like, we have the turtle. We have the worst Silver Age that can produce as far as supervillains because they're all like, I'm the dreidel man, you know, stuff like that. And so they're like, well, let's just make them all creepy serial killers and rapists now. So that happened. Black Hand is another case where he was a Green Lantern villain who was, this was a write-up I found online that was so on point that I'll just repeat it. Thank you. Black Hand was once a pathetic joke with a weapon that was dependent on stealing energy from Green Lantern's ring and a gimmick of committing crimes based on famous folk sayings. Then he found out he's destined to be the Antichrist, leader of an army of zombie supervillains. That's the 2000s.
Yep.
You know, Dr. Destiny was a Silver Age villain that much.
Yeah.
He almost never did anything. But then Neil Gaiman did that one Sandman story called 24 Hours, which made it much creepier and horrible.
And that is a really, really, that's one of Gaiman's uglier stories, to be sure.
And Alan Moore on whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow Superman story, the final villain was Mr. Mitzelpilek, who, you know, was the silliest thing ever, turned into this utterly horrible kind of Lovecraftian monster at the end. So there's lots of little twists.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Do you find that a lot of these character tone shifts are due to like what's happening in real life? Like they're from like whatever political thing is happening or I guess that's all I can think of right now. But people have a more cynical view of the world, so it's making its way into their writing of these characters.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's all tonal shift. Like, if you look at the 90s, and you look at, like, the X-Men of the 90s, you get a bunch of villains that are just, like, hardcore and edgy. Yeah. I got a billion guns on me. Extreme. My name's Extreme. And, or Fitzroy, because that sounds like the 90s. And then you hit the 2000s, and we're like, we're kind of past that, and we're getting a little bit more interested in telling these stories about serial killers.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
I think a lot of these characters that are from the Silver Age were very lighthearted and silly, and they're right. trying to make them relevant in the modern age, which sometimes then plays into darkening
yep.
them.
Because like, one of the examples was the Turtle. That is an actual Flash villain whose power is to go really slow. And for the Flash, that's supposed in the Silver Age, that's a fun little thing you could do. How yeah. can the Flash slow down to stop this guy who is going so slow that you should be able to stop him anyway? So they turned him into like a really creepy character that was kind of a monster that sucked everybody's speed out of them and their life force. So it's just like, you know, the only way it felt like in that time period to do anything to make it seem like a threat was to just make it as weird and creepy as you could.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But they still wear their costumes from the Silver Age. So it's almost creepy.
It's off-putting, right?
Yeah, it's a little off-putting.
Yeah.
there's that 50s weightiness and gravitas that comes with naivete. And when I was writing the latest Panel Jumper episode, I saw, you know, I'm tracking the course of Godzilla's growth as a character and his evolution as a character, but also the other giant monster movies of the time are from this... There's this naivete, but there's also this weighty seriousness that is kind of the stock and trade of Mystery Science Theater. You know,
mm-hmm.
now we are very cynical. Now we step back and make fun of these documentaries and these horror films, these science fictions that are so full of so much concern
mm-hmm.
and like I said, gravitas and weightiness.
And they were trying so hard.
Yeah, and you know, because they, and go ahead.
Well, finish your thought. I don't want to interrupt that thought, but I'll hit you something.
I think I had found holes in it as I was thinking. Okay. And so I need you now. I need you.
So on that you
save me.
As you were saying there, one of my favorite movie reviews ever compared the Godzilla movie that came out the same time that Pacific Rim came out.
Uh-huh.
And the point they made was that Godzilla movie really wanted you to take it seriously, and they would have the parts where the scientists would be like, this is man's error and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Pacific Rim really wanted you to like Ron Perlman's shoes. You know, like, yeah. that's the difference. There's yeah. so many scenes where everybody's just looking seriously at Godzilla, and they're like, you should take this seriously, audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're being told to be embarrassed by our earlier earnestness.
Yes.
And yeah. that was, thank you. You bought me time.
You
You're
go.
My friend. I love you. There you go. Yeah, and we shouldn't dwell on that earnestness anymore, because that's naive. That makes us vulnerable. Now we're tough. Now we're grown up. Now we have bad guys that are actually a physical and psychological threat to our well-being, as opposed to stealing jewelry from behind the counter.
Yeah. One last one I'll throw in, because yeah. It makes me think of like it was happening before the 2000s. Mark Waid did some stuff during the late 90s where a bunch of villains sold their souls to a demon he created. And so one of the most innocent villains in the history of DC was a guy named Killer Moth. And he has one of the most ridiculous costumes, and he's a failure. Like, his first night out, he got beat by Batgirl on her first night out, and it was just kind of like, he's a loser. So he cut a deal, and he ended up being turned into this horrible moth monster called Traxxas, who would eat people.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yep, there you go, Killer Moth. Do, 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 do. And now you're just like feasting on the flesh of the police. Welcome to the 2000s.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
You know, so.
What was that demon's name? He's one of the lords.
Neron.
All right. Well, let's move on. But the next thing I want to talk about is kind of related to this, because after the whole Batawang fiasco, DC head Pam Lifford was greatly displeased and told as much to publishers Jim Lee and Dan Didio.
So offended.
And so that fallout led to a total rethinking of the adult-themed Black Label line. And
she sounds like a Sith Lord. I am greatly displeased.
And
with this penis.
I kind of hope hope that's what happened.
Basically, she wants the characters, the DC characters, to match the expectations that DC has set up. And so we had a discussion about this on our Facebook group about what this might mean for Vertigo, for Black Label. And so let's briefly talk about what might this mean for Black Label.
I don't know what that phrase means. I find it problematic. What does it mean to you guys? Meet the what expectations? DC has made such a mess of their character continuity and their storytelling philosophy. I don't even know what that means anymore.
She's coming in relatively new, and I think there was a bit there that she used to work for Disney.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the thing is, they want to make sure that no matter what, at most points the character is appropriate enough, even in the more adult stories, that you could still sell a t-shirt with them.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like that's what the concern is. So that might actually mean like maybe something good for the mainstream DC Comics. It's something bad for Vertigo and Black Label. It's a neutering, but you said they're already neutered, and you are correct.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, wasn't that the whole point of Vertigo to begin with? Which
right.
is yep. we have this adult line of stories that, and that's why we had the phrase, why they added the brand sophisticated suspense to Swamp Thing, because
mm-hmm.
it didn't fit anymore,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't know what to do because the comic was selling so well, but hey, Swamp Thing really can't fit. After Alan Moore's like done all his business with this character, it doesn't really fit in this universe anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then that led to some really inspired storytelling, probably some of the best stuff we got out of the 90s.
And that's the point of making an imprint in general, is
exactly.
to be able to tell stories yeah. that you can't tell in the main
right.
universe.
Mm-hmm. And then Didio, in his infinite idiocy, you know, decided that no, we're going to take all these, you know, best-selling characters like Constantine and Swamp Thing and Sandman, Daniel, and we're going to put them back into the superhero universe because that's what readers want. Guy's moron on toast.
Well, this moron on toast goes on to say that Pam Lifford is very much built for the franchise business and the brand part of the business, and because of that, they're trying to make sure that the tonality, the voice of the books, have a sensibility that seems to match what people's expectations are, which means yeah, we need to sell merchandise, right. so we need to keep the comics.
It's the vaguest way to say that.
I don't think it's a bad thing. It's because
it's not except that this Black Label line has been marketed not to children,
right.
not to, you know, mass market as like, you know, this is the main deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's been like very clear. It's its own thing. Well, it hasn't been very clear, but I mean, it's an Elseworlds, you know, like it's doing its own stories and getting its own writers to do the thing that they want to do and play in that sandbox.
But you guys agree that the continuity of DC superhero storytelling is so muddy anymore.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons why I gave up after the last reboot was like, I don't understand who lives in what world and who plays with who anymore. I'm totally confused by this. Like I gave up on the Superman and the Batman books because I'm like, I'm not sure what puzzle pieces go together anymore because of all this.
Right.
And that's got to be terribly, terribly confusing to anybody that's familiar with the old branding, you know? So I don't think the Black Label, I think the Black Label line was probably, it was ill-conceived.
Mm. Yeah, probably was.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that, I mean, there could be potential within it, but nothing on its initial launch had me interested or excited.
Right.
And, it sounded as kind of like Marvel had the Max line, which served its purpose for
right.
a particular point
right.
in history. And it sounds like this was just coming a little too late to it. And it also sounded like it was merging a different marketing idea because Jim Lee and Didio can't shut up about their concept of the evergreen. And so they were shoving this. They were like, oh, yeah. Evergreen titles, that's what Black Label's about. So we're going to put old things such as Kingdom Come as
yeah.
a Black Label. Like
yeah.
Kingdom Come is one of the most, I mean, it's dark in some sense, but you don't have Constantine going around swearing left and right, and you don't have a Batawang in Kingdom Come. So there's a certain thing. All-Star Superman was going to go Black Label, and it's just like, I don't know. That's one of like the happiest, brightest Superman stories I've ever read.
Yeah.
So that basically it was just kind of an umbrella concept for a few ideas, and they were just throwing things in there. That's what it felt like to me. So,
well,
right. I forgot that they were squeezing those other titles in there too, like
yeah.
retconning them in there.
Yep.
Yeah. Sorry, Ben.
I was just going to make a joke and say Black Label is also a brand of a Johnny Walker whiskey. So maybe that's what they were drinking when they came up with
yeah,
this.
Yeah, maybe, maybe. Also, can we just get over the fact that Bruce Wayne has a penis? Because, like, it's really grating on my nerves right now that people get so offended by it. I don't know.
It's kind of so sad.
And I've yet to meet somebody who was offended, but maybe that's because I'm in Seattle.
It's because everyone's excited about it.
There you go.
Yeah. But she's clearly offended by it.
He's not a Ken doll. Anyway, let's move on to Book Report, everybody. Let's start with you, Cole Hornaday. What do you want to tell us about?
You may recall from a couple of years ago, if you've been listening to nearly 200 episodes of the Perfectly Bound podcast, that I'm a big fan of Evan Dorkin and Jill Thompson's Beasts of Burden Dark Horse series. And there was at one point, I think I gathered up all the stories from that point in time.
I think we went through it like bit by bit to figure out what was in the collected editions.
So, Chris, help me out here. Is this the new Beasts of Burden? Is that an ongoing series or is it a mini too?
I think it's a mini.
It's
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, sadly, Jill Thompson is not associated, is not drawing, painting, and doing her magic work with it. But Dorkin, who's a co-creator of the series, is. Benjamin Dewey is painting the illustrations. He does okay. Doesn't have the magic of Thompson. I don't know if I'm going to make it through this series. I'm so incredibly disappointed in it. One of the things I loved about the original Beast of Burden story is that it. I love stories that work from the point of less is more, and they work with constraints. So we are given this story where dogs and some cats and other animals are protecting us from the evil around us with aspects of magic that they pass through their dog and cat cultures. And they don't really lean too much on humans to get the job done. And that's one of the things I loved about it is they were struggling with these constraints. They don't have hands, they don't have fingers, but they have these. But they can communicate with one another and they can problem solve. And the scope of the stories were small and really intriguing and gave a lot of room for the characters to breathe and grow. Dorkin's not doing that anymore. He's giving these animals big magical powers. There was like one of the climax, or it was a flashback or climax scene from issue number one, where the dogs are shooting rays of magical energy at the demon and burning things and setting things on fire. And I'm like, all of a sudden, these magical dogs and cats are now superheroes. And that's not what the story was originally about. Mm-hmm. And then we come to find out that, well, you know, some of these magical dogs actually have human companions and they work side by side with them and they communicate with them. I'm like, that's not the rule. That's not the world you set up before. And that was really disappointing to me as well. So, he's just kind of, I don't know why he found he needed to do this. Maybe, you know, sometimes I think that writers feel like, well, I've got to build on this world because there's this expectation on me to make this a more complete world. And I'm like, no, I don't think you needed to do that. I think you just needed to tell the tight little stories that you told up to this point. But now we're in like the wizarding world of Beasts of Burden and it's cheapened it and I'm not having as much fun with it. I'm serious. I will finish reading it. I'm just had to say that because I'm being because I'm mad. I'm disappointed that he's kind of lost touch with that very simple magic that he'd brought into his original story. So, Chris, have you read this?
I read the first issue, and I liked it.
Yeah?
But I'm going to wait till it's done and then get the hardcover, because I have the first hardcover.
Right.
And I must complete the set.
I don't need magical wizard dogs. I want dogs that can you know, problem solve, solve mysteries, keep us safe, and we never know about it, and which is still what is happening, but the scope is kind of like blown out of control as far as I'm concerned.
I understand your complaint.
Yes.
And I do appreciate the original stuff for having that. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you just said magical wizard dogs still makes me happy.
Okay.
So I just have a hard time saying no to a dog book.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I'll read it too. But if this is the direction he's going to go with these stories, I think I may be done.
Right.
All right. Thank you, Cole.
Sure.
Chris Cassell, what do you got?
So I'm still on vacationing back in 2015 and catching up with certain projects.
Dude.
And I got a bunch.
Secret Wars took too much time.
Yes, and it burned you out.
I read like first issues and then got the trade, and I was like, "Yeah, I'll
look." I bounce back from Secret Empire. You get to work, Turkey.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
He read more than any human
this
should.
True. This is true. You did.
So I have read Ballistic. This is from Black Mass Studio, back when it was a much younger studio.
Mm-hmm.
And
studio.
Yep, and it was written by Adam Egypt Mortimer and drawn by Derek Robertson of Transmetropolitan. And it is a very, what's the word I want to use? What's that movie? Videodrome?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cronenberg.
Cronenberg. It's very Cronenberg. That's it. It's a alternate future where so many disasters have happened that we live in a organic techno future.
Oh, yeah.
Of demons, demon guns, and like the main character is a air conditioning repairman for mobsters, and he has a talking gun that jacks into his arm when he uses it and feeds off his adrenaline, and they're like best friends and they're partners, and they're gonna do some jobs together. And it's kind of a noir story where there's it's a little too complicated to sum up. Overall, I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed Derek Robertson because he makes things look gross very well. But the script and the world is trying so hard to be Warren Ellis and Grant Morrison at the same time, and it just feels like that. Like he just read a bunch of Invisibles and just read Transmetropolitan, and he just mushed them together. And he's supposed to be a film director, and everybody was so excited about him. And I think I looked up IMDb like a couple weeks ago, and he still hasn't had a movie put out or something like that. So, and this, there's like a lot of people that were hyped about this in 2015. I remember reading tons of reviews and like, this is the future. And I don't remember seeing him do anything else, Adam Egypt or Mortimer. So it has moments, it has a sense of humor, it has art that I like, but it just tries too hard. And at, by the end of it, I just kind of felt like, eh, nice try.
All
almost
right.
Got it. It is a $15 trade. It's a good value for how dense of a read is. I'm being just a little too meh about that. If you like Derek Robertson, you will like this. And if you like Cronenberg stuff, you'll like it because there's not that much Cronenberg stuff in this medium. So Ballistic, it was okay.
And they have what looks like a 57 Chevy with dragon wings, so yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, there's cool things in there.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Mm-hmm. And finally, Nicole, what do you got for us?
This is a new release as of this recording, Water Snakes by Tony Sandoval. And it's I've been flirting with Tony Sandoval's stuff for a long time. The first one that came out was Doom Boy. I haven't read it, but I have looked at it so many times. And then A Glance Backward is one that I saw in previews. And I was like, Tony Sandoval, maybe I'll finally read something. And I still didn't. And then Water Snakes came out, and it's a bunch of bad B ITCHs on the cover and like warrior women. And I was like, okay, I can't not read this one.
And there's squiddy guys.
And there's like weird octopus stuff and teeth obsessions and maybe ghosts, and it kind of becomes a fairy tale. It's really good. It's weird though. So it's focusing on this girl, Mila, and she doesn't seem to have many friends, and she comes across this girl who seems kind of like flirting with her sort of thing, and they become friends, and Mila is like obsessed with her teeth. She's like, your teeth are just like amazing. And we don't know why she's so obsessed with her teeth. And she seems to be the only one who can see this girl. This girl pukes up an octopus. There's no easy way to say this, guys. Squid happens, you know? So it wasn't really a squid, but I had to. And then it just becomes this like dream slash fairy tale slash long-term fulfillment of a long battle between a king and other spirits, and I don't know. I really don't, but it's great. I kind of like a reverse fairy tale because, you know, so many times it comes in like, there is legend and the king who has never been and he was cursed. It's like it didn't start that way. It's just like this lonely girl who she's like, I don't know, am I gay? Because I'm like really into this girl. But then it's just like, no, it's cool. We're all straight. It's fine. And then weird stuff happens. So if you're looking for something that is kind of like, ooh, I don't know, but it's entrancing. And then also squid, octopus. Yeah, it's not an easy way to describe it, but it was an extremely enjoyable experience. And Tony Sandoval has this way where he kind of reminds me of, who was that Liquid Television guy, like the cartoonist, like Bill Plumpkin?
Plimpton.
It's like it almost reminds me of like a simplified, over-exacerbated like Plimpton. Like a little bit, but people have huge heads and like tiny features that are spread all over their faces. Yeah. And these weird body proportions. It's like they're sticks with like tiny little pom-poms for boobs on their bodies. And it's the teeth stuff because like Plimpton would do these things where like faces were eating their own faces, like going in and out of themselves.
Ears.
And it has that motion to it and that feel. And so it really, I'm really drawn to the artwork.
But I bet you he was raised off of Plimpton.
He must have watched some Liquid TV. I looked up, he's from Mexico too. So I don't know. That's just a thing. So maybe he was watching Liquid TV in Mexico. Yeah.
Where he went to a Mike and Ike film festival or something. Not Mike and Ike, but there's weird animation festivals.
Spike and Mike.
Yeah, like I could see Tony doing animation and having that feel to it. I don't know if I would call it cerebral. Is that something that you can call it when it's weird and dreamlike like that? Or are cerebral things are supposed to be like making you think?
Well, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know words. I just know it's weird and it was highly enjoyable and it was beautiful to look at. I could pore over the pages.
Ethereal.
Yes. It does become one of those things where it's like, is it a dream or is it not? Doesn't matter. It was great, you know, as opposed to when somebody just wakes up and goes, it was all a dream. That doesn't happen. So you don't have to worry about that.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
Water snakes. Thank you, Nicole. Mm-hmm. Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as the Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcast at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcasts@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
Thank you. Well, this quiz time is in recognition of Washington State Initiative 1634, a.k.a. the Soda Pop Tax. I present to you the choice of a new generation, a quiz time devoted to fictitious soft drinks guaranteed to not cause diabetes or obesity because they ain't real.
All right.
You with me?
Yeah.
All right.
Sure.
First up, this Willy Wonka concoction went beyond Red Bull. It didn't merely give the consumer metaphorical hyper-caffeinated wings. It allowed them to defy gravity itself.
Fizzy lifting drink.
That's right, Ben Lawrence. Fizzy lifting drink featured in Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the book that was published in 1964 and the film from 1971. This elevating soft drink lets the consumer fly without wings. In a typically morbid Roald Dahl twist, Charlie and Grandpa Joe nearly die after floating too close to a giant industrial fan. But Fizzy lifting drink is still a soda, and the day was saved by some prodigious belching. Next, this refreshingly addicting cola is the number one soft drink of tomorrow, according to the populace of Matt Groening's Futurama.
Slurm
cola is produced in a factory on the planet Wormulon by a race known as Slurm Worms. Their corporate mascot is, do you recall?
No.
Slurms McKenzie. It's the original party worm. However, sales of Slurm plummeted after the Planet Express crew discovered the addictive liquid was actually excreted from a giant worm's behind.
Aww.
Slurm first appeared in the Futurama episode Space Pilot 3000. Next up, this is a popular wizarding beverage described as tasting a little bit less sickly than butterscotch. or a little bit less sickly butterscotch, and is served at numerous locations in the Wizarding World and has a very slight alcoholic content. Students of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry could often buy this when visiting Hogsmeade.
Butterbeer.
Butterbeer was first introduced in J.K. Rowling's novel Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, published in 1999. Muggles can now purchase an alcohol-free butterbeer distillation at the Wizarding World of Harry Potter theme park.
I bet it tastes gross.
I do not have any interest in trying. With the brand slogan, "Sometimes even superheroes get thirsty," this soft drink can be found in all corners of the DC universe. Because of his flaky nature, Booster Gold lost and won numerous promotional gigs with the company, whose promotion plant now fronts the super secret facility known as the Lab, whatever that is. Soda Cola was, come on, one of your favorite books, buddy. Soda Cola first appeared in Resurrection Man number 3.
Can't remember it.
Yeah, you convinced me I needed to read Resurrection Man. That was almost the end of our friendship. created by Andy Lanning and Dan... I'm not serious.
No, all right. No,
created by Andy Lanning and Dan Abnett with art by Butch Geist, Resurrection Man. Lastly, this is going to be a toughie, gang, but bear with me. This classic slushy beverage is available throughout the J.J. Abrams oeuvre and is purportedly made of special ingredients called Seabed's Nectar, which give it a highly addictive quality but also make it extremely healthy.
Is this part of the Cloverfield stuff? I don't know.
Slusho is a soft drink manufactured by the company Tegrotto. The company was featured in the film Cloverfield. Okay, so you get half a point for that. as well as other bad robot properties like Alias, Fringe, Star Trek, and Super 8. Slusho is available in the following flavors: Blueberry Zoom, Chocolate Rage, Mekon, Nashi, Banana Anime, and Strawberry Tasty. And that is quiz time.
All right.
There was also an episode of Adventure Time all dedicated to Super Porp, which was a soda that kept getting replenished even after the Great Mushroom War because robots, just droids, came and did it. And there's like this whole episode around it. It's
excellent.
Weird. Yeah.
All right.
Super Bowl.
Cool.
All right. Well, thank you, friends. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching if you watch. And we will see you next week.